The headlines: Joe Biden takes the oath of office as the 46th U.S. president amid unprecedented challenges that he is facing at home and abroad. U.S. President Donald Trump defends his much-criticized policies as he leaves the White House ahead of the inauguration of his successor, Joe Biden. And Iran's president says Donald Trump's political career is over today, while the bipolarity of the U.S. society and Washington's isolation are what he has left behind. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Joe Biden is sworn in as the 46th president of the U.S. in a ceremony at the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph Robinette Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden, Jr., do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. Thank President.
You. 78-year-old Biden took the oath of office amid tight security. In his inaugural address, Biden vowed to defeat political extremism and domestic terror. He also pledged to be a president for all Americans, saying that he would seek unity. Biden takes office at a moment of profound economic, health, and political crises. The swearing-in ceremony has ended Trump's turbulent 4 years in office. Donald Trump has left the White House for the final time, hours before the inauguration of Joe Biden as the country's new president. Trump, along with his wife, walked a short red carpet and then delivered a brief speech before boarding a helicopter on the White House lawn. He headed to a nearby military base to board Air Force One for the last time to fly to Florida. At the base, Trump also delivered a speech in which he defended his much-criticized policies. He described his four-year term as incredible, saying that his administration accomplished a lot.
What we've done has been amazing by any standard. We rebuilt the United States military. We created a new force called Space Force. That in itself would be a major achievement for a regular administration. We were not a regular administration.
The outgoing president also wished the new administration great luck and great success. However, he would skip the inauguration of successor Biden in an extraordinary break with tradition. Trump will be at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida when Biden is sworn in as the 46th president of the U.S. He's the first president in more than 150 years to snub the inauguration of his successor. Political commentator Don DeBar says the U.S. remains a divided nation as Donald Trump leaves the White House ahead of the swearing-in of a new president.
The condition under which he leaves is one where the country is divided in half, just like the condition under which he came into office. We saw that his term in office was essentially marked by a witch hunt by the other half. He was in a state of siege in the White House. Half the population said, not my president, considered him illegitimate, had a hate that's really quite remarkable. And that was stoked by the media wall to wall here. The same conditions exist going in, with the exception of the media's antipathy. Joe Biden has had absolute free ride from the media here. Some of the things that they allowed to go by during the campaign, particularly the allegations of corruption, which were substantiated a hell of a lot more than any of the Russia stuff that was thrown at Trump. He got a free ride from the media, but as I said, half the population considers, and with some good cause, that he's an illegitimate president, and there's a great deal of hostility towards him.
Ronnie Carvello is a correspondent joining us from Miami. Well, Ronnie, we know that the U.S. president is on his way there to the state anyways. Tell us what may be expected there and any other developments regarding his departure.
Well, first of all, I'd like to mention that before he heading to the Andrew Air Force Base to get the Air Force One to head to Florida, he flew over the Capitol, the Congress, and then he was able to see his legacy, what he was leaving behind. A lot of police officers on the ground, the military presence, And that was what is expected to be his legacy, completely chaos. But he's heading to Florida right now. He's about an hour, 15 minutes from where I am right now, driving, obviously. And when he arrived, he's going to expect some problems. He should have some problems with the city. Not right now, not today, but in the next 21 days. Because actually, where he's going to be is not a house, it's a club. And the license is to operate a club. Therefore, he's not allowed to stay there more than 21 days. So honestly, I don't know what he's going to do. But also the neighbors, there is a movement against his presence because of the trouble that will bring with his presence in the area, which is a very quiet neighborhood. So he's facing not only the neighborhoods, but as well the ordinance of the city.
There's been a lot of rumors about what the U.S. presence is going to do when he's in Florida. Can you give us any clues as to whether those rumors are true, if there are any that are out there?
No, except playing golf.
And you talked about how his neighbors are not too enthusiastic about where he's going to be, obviously. Are they going to be doing anything legally against him and his residence there?
Well, there's a signatures. They are collecting signatures against his presence. This has been going on for a month now, and it also, and of course, put a lot of pressure on the city in order to comply with the laws, which do not allow anybody to live in that club for more than 21 days. Also, the daughter, Ivanka Trump. She just bought a $32 million property, land, in the Miami area in the city called Surfside, which is the continuation of Miami Beach. And they are building a house over there. And there is I mentioned that because there is a possibility of a political interest in that as well, as far as like they may be pursuing, I don't know who, which one of the if it's the daughter or the son of, obviously not Trump itself, but himself, but they may pursuing a political career here in Florida.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Ronnie Corbello talking to us there from Miami. Moving on. On the very last day of President Donald Trump's administration, a polarized U.S. remains on the edge over the prospect of election-related violence. But while a significant minority is set to see Trump leave, a majority in the U.S. and seemingly across the world appear to be quite happy that the Trump era has come to an end. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
The final sun is setting on the presidency of Donald J. Trump. Domestically, many are not just breathing a sigh of relief, but screaming with happiness. And yet polls say 35% of the country believes he is being ousted illegitimately. That illustrates just how polarizing Trump has been here. And while many wonder if he'll run for president in 2024, many others hope he is leaving public office permanently.
Alhamdulillah, that tomorrow is Trump's last day in the White House as the president of the United States. I don't feel that it is Trump's last day as being a tyrant, being a terrorist, being a thief. But I feel that I'm very happy that that we can get back to moving forward here in the United States.
Trump seemed to combine Barack Obama's skill in manipulating the media, George W. Bush's readiness to provoke international hatred, Bill Clinton's ability to disregard the truth, and Ronald Reagan's jingoism. He was routinely and credibly accused of conduct which degraded public service, of re-legitimizing American white supremacy, of intentionally provoking societal rifts, and much, much more. Trump's ascension provoked the greatest burst of political activity and independent journalism in the U.S. in 50 years. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the importance of voting, and other progressive movements seem to be in direct response to his regular use of sexism, racism, jingoism, and elitism. Internationally, Trump took America's post 9/11, you're either with us or against us worldview to a new extreme. He illegally tore up international agreements, banned travel from seven mostly Muslim countries, and antagonized longtime U.S. allies. Trump, who switched his party affiliation 5 times, has successfully reshaped the Republican Party. He was the first 21st century mainstream politician to be openly anti-free trade, to voice opposition to America's endless wars, to admit the national decline of the U.S. since the Great Recession, to bring attention to the role of a deep state in the U.S., and to openly question the integrity of the nation's corporate-dominated media. The Trump era was truly unlike any other. His legacy will be debated, but his detractors are innumerable, intense, and international. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Russia says any improvements in relations with the U.S. would depend on the incoming administration of Joe Biden in Washington. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Russia will live as it has for hundreds of years, seeking good relations with the U.S. Peskov added whether Washington works toward achieving the same goal will depend on Biden and his team. Washington-Moscow ties have been deteriorated over the past couple of years, with the Trump administration pulling out of the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The 2010 New START Treaty is also set to expire in February. Negotiations on the nuclear pact stalled amid Washington's push to have China on board. The U.S. recently also blamed Kremlin-backed hackers for a massive cyber attack, adding to a long list of grievances plaguing ties between the two countries. The Iranian president says U.S. President Donald Trump's dark and vicious rule has come to an end, leaving behind a legacy of political isolation for Washington.
One of the results of Trump's amateurish and tyrannical actions was the bipolarity of the U.S. society. Political isolation of the United States was another legacy of Trump. The U.S. was left alone in its policies. It was left alone when acting against Palestine because the majority of world countries opposed the U.S. America was also left alone regarding the Iran nuclear deal.
Rouhani added the U.S. under Trump was isolated on other occasions also. He said the U.S. failed to rally the U.N. Security Council's support against the Iran nuclear deal and failed to reinstate an arms embargo against Tehran. President Rouhani said Trump's multiple failures at the U.N. was a disgrace for the U.S. The Iranian president said that his country expects the new U.S. administration to make up for the mistakes of Trump's government.
Today, we expect those who take power at the White House to return to law. We expect them to deliver on their commitments and try, if they can, to remove all the dark stains left on the U.S. in the past 4 years, because some of those dark blots cannot be removed. The new U.S. administration will shoulder a heavy responsibility.
President Rouhani said the new U.S. administration should also begin abiding by international law and resolutions. He said that if they act in good faith and show their honesty, not only in word but in deed, Iran will fully comply with its commitments. Rouhani said the whole world realized that the so-called U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran and its economic terrorism failed. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh says U.S. sanctions and military threat against Iran have failed. It's time now for Washington to replace those policies with a conflict resolution approach.
Biden seems to be moving along the same road, given the manifesto that he has released on CNN with regard to containing Iran's missile program, regional program, nuclear program and power. It seems to be the very same case that was put into action by President Obama and was continued by President Donald Trump. He's looking for the same containment strategy. Unless the United States shifts its strategy and drops its containment strategy and replaces it with a conflict resolution approach, then the United States would go along playing the same rules of the game with sanctions and threats, and Tehran would show resistance. But this time, there is a major difference. They have already failed. The two pillars of this game, the sanctions and the threat, they have been crippled. They have failed in achieving any success. And now Tehran knows how to play this game. This is very important. Point two, the United States is suffering from divisions, rifts, and very severe confrontation between two groups of this nation. Now they are weaker than ever. And we do know that foreign policy starts at home. When they have such big problems at home, they are weak in practicing their hegemony and their will abroad.
Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reiterated his country's opposition to fresh talks with the U.S. over the 2015 nuclear deal.
There is no need for negotiations at all. The U.S. government has broken the law and breached its commitments. No one can hold talks for implementing their own commitments.
Zarif said if the U.S. lifts sanctions and implements its commitments under the deal, Iran will also return to the full compliance with the agreements. Earlier, the EU foreign policy chief called on the U.S. to return to the Iran nuclear deal and stop its policy of sanctions against Tehran.
It is a deal, and the deal had a nuclear side and an economic side. The Iranians are ready to go back to the full commitment, fulfillment of their commitments, if we, the other part of the deal, the Western world, fulfills also our commitments. And for that, we need the Americans to go back to the agreement, or at least to stop threatening with sanctions to everybody who participates in the economic relationship with Iran.
Borrell, in a letter to the EU foreign ministers, also warned that the agreement is at a critical juncture. The United States withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. 1 year later, Tehran began reducing its commitments. They said the measures were in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to make up for Washington's pullout on sanctions. Iran has time and again said the measures are reversible if its economic interests are safeguarded, as enshrined in the nuclear deal. The second and final day of Iranian Army Ground Forces drills has been conducted in the southern port city of Jask. This time, some unique and special operations were practiced by the troops at shore and at sea. Human Abadi reports.
The war games by Iran's Army Ground Forces have continued, with Chinook choppers taking divers to Makran coast waters to attack hypothetical enemies. After descending, they swam to the seashore while carrying their guns. Then they launched an attack on mock enemy targets and positions. Another group of these divers began to shoot at enemies at sea to destroy their boats. After finishing their mission, the same helicopters returned to the coast to take them back. On the second day, Brigade 223 took the lead by deploying its rangers from inland bases to coasts in Jask port in order to show off their capabilities in confronting with enemies. Iran's Army Ground Forces staged different types of missions to show the enemies that any possible threat would be answered swiftly. After that, the Army Air Force copters flew over the region to give support to Rangers by firing at enemy hideouts.
This operation proved that our forces are capable of carrying out quick missions wherever they are ordered to. We also showed that our troops are able to destroy enemy positions on the onshore lands.
With these exercises, Army's maneuvers came to an end, but the commanders made assurance that if the enemies would think of threatening Iran's national interests, a harsh response will be shown.
Iran's army plays a very important role in safeguarding the country's territorial integrity, and its forces on the land, in the air, and at the sea are always ready to conduct the missions. Human Abadi, Jask.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
The specter of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought and conflict contributed to the famine, which swept through Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of the defiant regional government. Leaders of Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost 3 decades, but were sidelined after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. The article you're about to hear has been written by Kara Anna. The piece is titled Extreme Urgent Need, Starvation Haunts Ethiopia's Tigray. The article has been taken from the Chronicle.com website. Please stay with us for more of Kara Anna's article. From emaciated refugees to crops burned on the brink of harvest, starvation threatens the survivors of more than 2 months of fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The first humanitarian workers to arrive after pleading with the Ethiopian government for access describe weakened children dying from diarrhea after drinking from rivers. Shops were looted or depleted weeks ago. A local official told a 1st of January crisis meeting of government and aid workers that hungry people had asked for a single biscuit. Participants say more than 4.5 million people, nearly the region's entire population, need emergency food. According to minutes obtained by the Associated Press, at their next meeting on 8th of January, a Tigray administrator warned that without aid and food, hundreds of thousands might starve to death, and some had already starved. Marie Carmen Vinoles, head of the emergency unit for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, told the Associated Press, "There is an extreme urgent need. I don't know what more words in English to use to rapidly scale up the humanitarian response because the population is literally dying every day. They are dying as we speak." But pockets of fighting, resistance from some officials, and sheer destruction stand in the way of a massive food delivery effort. The meeting's minutes said to send 15 kilograms of rations to 4.5 million people would require more than 2,000 trucks, while some local responders are reduced to getting around on foot. The specter of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought, conflict, and government denial contributed to the famine, which swept through the Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of defiant regional government. Leaders of the Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost 3 decades, but were sidelined largely after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict. More than 50,000 have fled into neighboring Sudan, where one doctor has said new arrivals show signs of starvation. Others shelter in rugged terrain. A woman who recently left Tigray region described sleeping in caves with people who brought cattle, goats, and the grain they had managed to harvest. A letter by the Catholic Bishop of Adigrat said recently, "It is a daily reality to hear people dying with the fighting consequences and because of lack of food." Hospitals and other health centers crucial in treating malnutrition have been destroyed. The United Nations says in markets, food is not available or extremely scarce and limited. Though Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed declared victory in late November, its military and allied fighters remain active amid the presence of troops from neighboring Eritrea, a bitter enemy of the now fugitive officials who once led the Tigray region. Fear keeps many people from venturing out. Others have fled. Tigray's new officials say more than 2 million people have been displaced. The United Nations says the number of people reached with aid is extremely low. A senior Ethiopian government official, Radwan Hussein, did not respond to a request for comment on Tigray colleagues' warning of starvation. A United Nations source said in the northern Shire area near Eritrea, which has seen some of the worst fighting, up to 10% of the children whose arms were measured met the diagnostic criteria for severe acute malnutrition, with scores of children affected. The source, speaking on condition of anonymity, sharing the concern of many humanitarian workers and aid workers about jeopardizing access to Ethiopia. Near Shire town are camps housing nearly 100,000 refugees who have fled over the years from Eritrea. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said recently, "Some who have walked into town are emaciated, begging for aid and begging for food that is not available." Food has been a target. Analyzing satellite imagery of the Shire area, a United Kingdom-based research group found two warehouse-style structures in the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, compound at one refugee camp had been very specifically destroyed. The DX Open Network could not tell by whom or who has done the destruction. It reported a new attack recently. It's challenging to verify events in Tigray region as communication links remain poor and almost no journalists are allowed to visit the region. Meanwhile, an official with Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, Vinoles, has said that in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum, the level of civilian casualties is extremely high in the places we have been able to access. She cited the fighting and lack of health care in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum. She said hunger is very concerning and that water is scarce in the region. Just 2 of 21 wells still work in Adigrat, a city of more than 140,000, forcing many people to drink from the local river. With sanitation suffering, disease is spreading fast in the region. Vinola said, You go 10 kilometers from the city and it's a complete disaster with no food. Humanitarian workers struggle to gauge the extent of the need of the peoples of the region. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director in Ethiopia, said, "Not being able to travel off main highways, it always poses the question of what's happening with people still off limits." Before the conflict, Ethiopia's National Disaster Management Body classified some Tigray wardas, or administrative areas, as priority regions or priority one hotspots for food insecurity. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director, said, "If some already had high malnutrition numbers 2.5 months into the crisis, it's a safe assumption that thousands of children and mothers are in immediate need of food and aid." The Famine Early Warning System Network says parts of central and eastern Tigray region are likely in emergency phase 4, just a step below famine. John Shumlansky, the Catholic Relief Services representative in Ethiopia, said the next few months are critical. Shumlansky said his group so far has given up to 70,000 people in Tigray region a 3-month food supply. Asked whether combatants use hunger as a weapon in Ethiopia, one concern among aid workers, John Shumlansky dismissed it by Ethiopian Defense Forces and police. With others, he didn't know. He said, "I don't think they have food either, though."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listener of Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Surah Al-Mujadala has 22 verses and was revealed in Medina, and it is the only chapter of the Quran in which all of the verses contain the blessed name of Allah. Due to the event of the dispute, Jidal, which is referred to in the first verse, this chapter has taken on the name of Al-Mujadala. The areas of discussion which are contained in this chapter include the following four. Area 1, the jurisprudential rule of Zihar, a form of divorce which existed during the pre-Islamic era of Jahiliyyah. Area number 2, the positive and negative examples of private discussions, Najwa. Area number 3, respecting people who enter into gatherings. And area number 4, separation between the party of Allah, Hezbollah, and the party of Satan, Hizb al-Shaytan. Specifics of the chapter. A majority of commentators of the Quran have stated that the opening verses of this chapter have a specific history behind their revelation, and they all point to one event. Even though there are slight differences in the various opinions of the scholars, however, these variations do not cause any major shifts of opinion. Now, the event of its revelation is as follows. A woman from amongst the Ansar named Khawla, also please note that there are other individuals whose names have been mentioned in the hadith with regards to the history of revelation, which we will not mention here. In any case, Khawla was from the clan of the Khazraj, and she was married to a man named Aus ibn Samit. One time they had an argument, and in the heat of the moment and the rage which came over the husband, and by his very nature, as he was known to be abrasive and quick to react, he decided to divorce his wife. And so he said to her, You are to me like my mother. Now, in that period of time, the pre-Islamic era of Jahiliyyah, when people were still transitioning to Islamic rules and laws, such a statement implied a divorce. However, it was a divorce which was irrevocable, while at the same time, the woman was not free to marry another person ever again, and thus it left the woman in the most difficult of positions. A short time passed, and Aus became upset at what he had done, and so he said to his wife, "I think that you have now become impermissible for me to be with you forever." Khawla replied, saying, "Do not say that. Go to the Messenger of Allah and ask him about the ruling for this issue." Aus replied, saying, "I'm ashamed to go and ask him." His wife retorted, "Then let me go and ask him." Her husband said, "No problem, go ahead." Thus, Khawla went to the Prophet of Allah and explained the situation to him as follows: "O Messenger of Allah, my husband, Aus ibn Samit, had taken me as his wife some time ago. I was a young lady at the time. I was beautiful. I had wealth. And I had a family to rely upon. My wealth is now all used up. My beauty and looks are now gone as I have become old. And my family have all dispersed, and I am now an old woman. My husband has performed a zihar divorce, and now he regrets it. Is there any way for us to return back to our previous married life?" The Prophet replied to her, saying, "You have now become unlawful, haram for him." Khawla retorted, "O Messenger of Allah, he did not say the verbal formula for divorcing me. He's the father of my children and my most beloved." The Prophet once again said to her, "You have now become unlawful, haram for him. I do not have any other rulings from Allah in regards to this situation." The woman kept insisting and praying, and finally she turned to Allah and said, "I complain to Allah for my difficult state and my need and condition that I find myself in. O Allah, please send down a ruling to your Prophet in regards to my situation." In the hadith, it is mentioned that the woman went on to say the following: "O Allah, indeed you know my state, so please have mercy upon me as I have young children. If this divorce cannot be reversed and I have to leave my children with their father, they will wither away as he will not be able to take care of them on his own. And if the children remain with me, then they will stay hungry as I too do not have the means to be able to provide for them." It was at this time that revelation, wahi, came to the Prophet, and the initial verses of this chapter descended upon him on how to resolve the issue of this case of zihar. Now when the Prophet received the verses, he asked Khawla to call her husband Aus to come and see him. When he arrived, the Prophet recited these initial verses to him and said, "Are you financially able to free a slave as the penalty, the kafara, for the zihar?" Aus replied, "If I do so, I will not have anything left for my family requirements." The Prophet then asked him, "Are you able to fast 2 months consecutively?" Aus once again replied, saying, "If I do not eat 3 times a day, my eyes will not function well, and I fear that by continuing to do so, I may go blind." The Prophet then asked him, "Are you able to feed 60 poor people?" To this, Aus said, "I can't do that either unless you help me in doing so." To his response, the Prophet replied, "I will help you and give you 15 sa'a." Now, this measure of food is sufficient to feed 60 people, and each person would receive 1 mud of food, or the equivalent of 1/4 of a man. And these are all weights of measurement which were used at the time of the Prophet of Islam. Thus, the Prophet assisted the man by giving him the means to expiate the zihar which he had instituted, and he used whatever the Prophet gave him to pay the penalty, the kafara. By doing so, he was able to return back to a normal life with his wife. Now, as we previously stated, many commentators of the Quran have acknowledged a similar history of revelation of the initial verses of this chapter, and this includes the likes of Al-Qurtubi, Al-Jaluti, Al-Alusi, Al-Tabatabai, Fakhr al-Din al-Razi, Sayyid Qutb, Abu al-Futuh al-Razi, and Fadil Miqdad. and the story of the history of revelation of these initial verses of Surah Al-Mujadala have also been related in many of the books of history and ahadith with slight differences. Merits of recitation. In regards to the merits of recitation of this chapter, there are two ahadith, one from Prophet Muhammad and one from Imam As-Sadiq. In the first tradition from Prophet Muhammad, it is stated, "It will be recorded for the one who recites Surah Al-Mujadala that on the Day of Judgment, they will be recognized as being of the party of Allah, Hizbullah." In addition, in a hadith from Imam As-Sadiq, it is mentioned, "The person who recites Surah Al-Hadid and Al-Mujadala in their obligatory prayers and continue to do so will not be punished by Allah and will remain in this state of protection until they leave this world. Nor will they see any evil coming to them, nor to their family, and they will never face poverty." Now, the aptness of the content of these two chapters and the subsequent rewards which are mentioned in this hadith become clear and evident when we reflect on the rewards which are promised. And this shows that the purpose of recitation is to implement the contents of these chapters in one's life, not just an empty recitation without thought and action.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to reports, over 25,000 uniformed American terrorists, much more than the number of CENTCOM terrorists in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and the Persian Gulf region combined, have turned Washington, especially the area around the Capitol Hill and the White House, into a military barracks for inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading Heart of International Terrorism in Fear of Infighting Among Local Terrorists. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After long decades of disturbing the peace of world countries, destabilizing towns and cities, destroying the heritage of humanity, and decimating millions of people around the globe, the trigger happy terrorists are finally being stationed where they ought to be. According to reports, over 25,000 uniformed American terrorists, much more than the number of CENTCOM terrorists in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and the Persian Gulf region combined, have turned Washington, especially the area around the Capitol Hill and the White House, into a military barracks for inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden and the formal kicking out of the defeated incumbent Donald Trump. It means the heart of international terrorism is trembling with a fear at the prospects of far greater violence and possible gunfights on January 20th. Following the storming of the Congress headquarters a fortnight ago by armed gangs incited by Trump. It is against the principal policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran to interfere in the internal matters of other countries. Nor are we in a position to judge the fairness of the American presidential elections. And neither we can foretell whether the Republican rogue, who for the past 4 years terrorized the world, would be acquitted or convicted of crimes committed in the U.S., not outside, where American presidents are free to do anything. Of course, we will be glad to see the terrorist Trump in handcuffs. We will also explore every avenue to see he and his accomplices get the deserving punishment for their unpardonable crime of killing the anti-terrorist icons, Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. Besides depriving Iran of over $300 billion of revenues by intimidating other countries with sanctions for doing business with the Islamic Republic. As for the fears of gunfights and possible deaths in Washington and all over the U.S. on January 20th, although we condemn acts of violence anywhere in the world and we have profound sympathies for the ordinary American citizens, it is not our concern whether the Democrats use uniformed terrorists to crush Trump's fully armed supporters or the Republicans succeed in splitting army ranks to make troops go at each other's throats. Anything can happen in the next few days in the U.S., where the jittery FBI has warned of the potential for armed protests and bitter infighting in Washington and at all 50 state capitol buildings ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration. And when this happens, to the relief of the free world, then the Americans should realize that history's most evil empire is in full spiral towards its impending doom, which means the birth of a new era in the northern part of the New World. Instead, the United States of America, that unlawfully expanded from the original 13 rebellious New England British colonies on the Atlantic seaboard to 50 illegal states, will be replaced by the same number of sovereign independent states where the black people, the Hispanics, the non-European migrants, and of course, the Native Amerindians will enjoy their birthrights. We're not daydreaming, but irrespective of whatever happens on January 20th, or does not happen, we definitely desire the end of the satanic aspirations of the United States of America. It is time for the curtain to come down on America's international terrorism, which means any sane person in the White House should not only withdraw the U.S. terrorist forces from all parts of the world, but stop the persecution of peace-loving masses oppressed by the Zionists, the Takfiris, and the ruthless regimes of spurious states.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The reason why the Islamic Republic is opposed to negotiating with the U.S.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The reason why I say that we will not negotiate with the U.S. is that it is pointless. Of course, they will benefit from negotiations. The poor thing, the old man who holds office in the U.S., seems to have made promotional use of negotiating with North Korea. He wants to take advantage of these negotiations either for electoral or non-electoral purposes. In any case, he has personal interests, but beyond these matters, the U.S. political system claims to be pursuing vital issues in the case of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, they say that we should forsake our defense capabilities and our regional and national power. Well, this is not possible. An honorable person who is interested in preserving the country's interests will not give in to these demands. This is what negotiation means. This is the reason why I am against negotiating with the U.S. Otherwise, we will negotiate with the entire world except for the U.S. and the fake Zionist regime.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Having relations, negotiating, and interacting with others, and we have no problem with it. This is America's problem with us. So this is another point. Sanctions are definitely curable, but the cure is not to retreat. So what is the cure? The cure for sanctions is only and solely reliance on national capabilities. We should preserve every capability that we have in this respect.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.